Increase in us religion. Did you notice that phrase from our opening collect or our prayer this morning? It's kind of a quaint old phrase. Increase in us true religion. I guess the assumption here is there must be untrue false religion, and we have to be careful, right? But if you've heard that phrase, true religion, these days, it's probably more likely at the mall, where you've seen the, right, you know what I'm talking about, right? The high-end, like, jeans, $200 jeans company, True Religion. There's another store called All Saints, right? Have you been to that one? It's all kind of like black and gray and really, you know, cool-looking stuff. When we were in Paris several years ago, we were walking on the streets and we came across a boutique called Kyrie Eleison, which is Greek for Lord have mercy, right? From the liturgy. But I think there's actually something quite refreshingly honest about these companies using this kind of language, religious language, right, to describe what they're doing. Because consumerism asks our worship, doesn't it? The theologian Jamie Smith says that going to the shopping mall is a liturgical experience, right? It's a kind of secular religious experience that has all sorts of ways in which there are rituals, and it's to shape really our desire. So think about this next time you go to Rosedale Mall. You know, maybe the Apple store is kind of like the temple in the middle of it, and the Genius Bar is the altar, right? And those like, you know, really smart tech workers wearing the color-coded t-shirts are like the acolytes or priests, you know? Our desires, our yearnings, our loves, if you will, are always being shaped one way or another, right? So we are worshipful creatures, and the question is, what do we worship? And the word worship just comes from, you know, old English worth-ship. So what we worship is what we deem worthy. Now, we live in our society amidst incredible material bounty, which is a good thing, right? So from a biblical perspective, material things and money are not evil, but actually good, right? Abundance is to be celebrated. The question is, what's our relationship to it? What is our love of it, and where does it fit in our lives? What is it doing in our lives? For it can mislead us. So today's text kind of hit on this theme in some different ways, and I want to spend some time unpacking them for you, because they talk about the danger of placing our ultimate trust in anything other than God. And so you might even want to pull out your bulletin as we walk through these texts, and let's just kind of get them in front of us. So I want to begin with Jeremiah, right? So Jeremiah, this prophet in ancient Israel. And this little passage we have for today is almost like a little lawsuit, right? It's almost a poetic lawsuit where God is both the plaintiff and the judge. And there's a complaint here against the people, right? God accuses the people in Jerusalem of betraying God by worshiping idols, right? So this is a basic spiritual error that people in the Bible make over and over again, and that people in our world and throughout human history tend to make, which is elevating to ultimate place in our lives that which is not actually ultimate. So in the case of Jeremiah, what had happened in his day was these fertility cults and these fertility gods had kind of crept back into the worship of ancient Israel. And the thing about a fertility cult or fertility god is the idea is you offer sacrifices, and the promise is that God will then provide rain or abundant harvests and meet your needs. So fundamentally, you are trying to manipulate the gods to take care of you. And what true God is calling them to account for in this text is that practice, right? Trying to control, trying to manipulate. Because to actually follow the true God, the God of freedom, means trusting and depending and not actually being in control. Learning to live in a very different kind of relationship with the source and ground of life. Idolatry is common because it's actually hard, right, to be led by God, to trust in God, to follow God in such a deep way. But Jeremiah's metaphor here is of the doing this, that idolatry like this is actually like pouring water into a cracked cistern. Now, I grew up in California in a dry climate, unlike Minnesota this year, right, where we've had so much water. Pouring precious water into a cracked cistern is the most futile and sad thing to do, right? It's an utter loss. It's a waste. So worshiping anything other than God not only estranges us from God, who is the primary relationship in our life, whether we acknowledge that or not, the very source of our life, the ground of our being, we might say, but it also has implications for how we relate to one another. So this is where I want to turn to the letter to the Hebrews in that text. And so you might flip your text over and look at that for a minute. In that first line, let mutual love continue. Mutual love. It's a powerful word. For this text and our gospel from Luke are all about a whole pattern, if you will, of relationships across social status and need, an invitation to a deeper mutuality shaped by love. And so there are some different kind of ways this gets concrete. The first is, do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for by doing so, some have entertained angels without knowing it, right? So this takes us back deep into the Bible to the book of Genesis, where there's this kind of strange encounter that Abram and Sarah have, and they're kind of in their tent out in the desert, and these three strangers show up. And they offer hospitality to them, and the strangers turn out to be messengers. An angel in the Bible is just a messenger, right? Bearing God's promise to them in a time when it seemed like God had given up on them. So in the ancient world, hospitality was a sacred practice because it invites us to recognize our shared humanity with a stranger, particularly in a world in which your survival depended upon hospitality. The guest is a fellow human being, and by sharing hospitality, you enter into a common humanity, a deep sharing that takes place, a mutual love, if you will. But the text then goes on to talk about other vulnerable people, like the incarcerated, victims of torture, and invites us in this text to actually recognize and identify with those who are in need. It also talks about the sacredness of marriage in a very radically mutual way in what was a patriarchal society, right? So men, not just women, should honor the marriage bed, right? The sacred mutuality that is here. So in all of this, there is a deep invitation to identify with one another, identify with those even who are vulnerable or who are of lesser status. So those of you who were here last week, you heard Don Samuels preach a wonderful, powerful sermon, arguing that we are the same underneath our differences, right? At a very deep level. And this text pushes us in that same direction. So that brings us then to the gospel from Luke, where Jesus is eating with the Pharisees. Now, the Pharisees were religious teachers who were very concerned about true religion, right? They wanted to know exactly what was right before God, and they were very anxious to kind of stamp out anything that was false. So that's partly why they're watching Jesus. Notice that part of it? They're watching him closely. Is he going to do something wrong? Is he going to do something impure? Is he going to offend against what they know to be true and right about God? Jesus goes on to share what might seem like a kind of basic piece of wisdom, right? So, you know, it's better to be raised to a higher status by your host than to kind of get demoted, right, to a lesser status, right? And of course, this is happening in Jesus's day in a culture that was all about honor and shame. And so it would be, you know, shaming to be, you know, sent down to the lower place. But I think there's something deeper going on here around the stakes, right? Which is that Jesus is actually calling into question a whole economy, right, that separates people and kind of accrues worth or assigns worth to them based on status. Jesus says, if you invite your friends or peers, your social peers, you know, they can repay you, right? They can, sure, there's mutuality in that sense, right? It can be a nice exchange. You know, you invite them over to your place, they invite you over to their place, everything's fine, you know? But it's better, actually, to invite those who cannot repay, the poor, the crippled, the lame, and the blind. Which would seem very strange in the wisdom of Jesus' day, and in many ways our day as well. Right? Because status is still very much with us. So I have to fly a lot for work, and I have platinum status on Delta, which is hard won, right? And it makes my experience of flying very different than before I had that, right? Now, it makes perfect sense for Delta to create these kinds of systems, right, for their business model. Like, I totally get that. But it's easy to get confused in this society that's always assigning us on some level a place in the line from first class to basic economy, right? Easy to get confused about that stuff and our underlying worth, right? And to miss the fact that we are all equally worthy in God's eyes. So what do we do with this, right? How do we live into this deeper mutuality? This is where our texts actually invite us into a simple practice that's really powerful. And that is the simple practice of generosity or sharing. So you say, across these texts, they all talk about this on some level, about giving, about offering sacrifices of praise to God, which is actually how we subvert our tendency towards idolatry in our lives, right? Praising God means recognizing God's ultimacy in our lives rather than other things or other people. And then sharing with one another, especially those in need, deepens our ability to live into that mutual love. God's generosity is foundational for our generosity. God is fundamentally generous, one of the core teachings of the Bible. God wants abundant life for us and provides for us and creates us actually to be generous people. So to practice generosity is to become more godlike, we might say, or to participate in God's life, in, we might say, the divine economy, which is fundamentally one of abundance and generosity. Well, a few weeks ago, we finished the renovation of our kitchen in Parish Hall, which involved a lot of generosity from many of us to make that happen. We spent the last month welcoming some of our neighbors experiencing homelessness through Project Home. Next Sunday, our Sunday evening dinners start up again. And if you haven't been to those dinners, I encourage you to come sometime, because a remarkable mix of people shows up. Some come physically hungry because they're struggling to afford enough food. Some come lonely because this is one of the few meals they eat each week with other people rather than alone. Some come with mental and emotional struggles. Everyone comes hungry for connection, community, and hope. And as we gather together and break bread, God's generosity and mutuality break through that experience. Let mutual love continue. So in a few minutes of silence that we're going to have right now, I invite you to think about one place in your life, in this next week, where you can practice generosity or sharing. Or maybe think about one way in which there's something in your life that you've put your ultimate trust in, rather than God, and what might it mean to get a different perspective on that? Amen.